When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, July 24th, the Kim K Skills Edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, back in the DC studio, and I'm joined in New York by Jessica Winter, editor and writer at Slate. Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Hannah. Welcome back.
Thank you. And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi. So before we get into our topics, I'm going to answer an old listener email because June kindly forwarded me a couple of listener emails about Orange is the New Black showing my book, The End of Men. One came from Madeline Imber in Australia saying, how does Hannah feel about this? So this is a completely like Hannah-centric little intro that I'm going to do here as my welcome back. And I would say I felt awesome. It's, you know, it was even they didn't do what the book says. They did sort of what the book represents, right? It's not like anything that was actually in the book was accurate to how they were portraying the book, but I love that even more. I mean, there was like Healy, the prison guard, huddled in a completely gray shot, but the book is in like neon yellow and pink. So that was cool. And he was kind of in a panic about the end of men. And then Pensatucky, who he was talking to, kind of got it right. Like her feelings about, you know, well, men never did anything good for me. And, you know, she sort of had that the closest to correct take. The way they ended it was even better, where it was like the men, but the men actually are in charge when they had that final scene where the prison guard, what's her name? The Figueroa, her husband was having an affair with another man at the end. So you felt like that was the final say on it. Well, it's not really the end of men because, you know, he's the one who's the most powerful guy in the show. He's about to become a politician. So it was cool. It was cool all around.
Did you like this season of Orange Is the New Black?
Me? You know, I have to admit that I kind of lost my I watched a little bit and then
it was all downhill after your cameo.
No, I like skipped to my cameo because it was on Twitter and I felt like an idiot. Like, shouldn't I watch? You know, I don't know. Shouldn't I watch it? So I skipped forward and then I never went back again. Somehow watching it out of order turned me off. Like it made it seem smaller. If you don't follow the storyline the natural way, then it doesn't grip you or something. I don't know. How about you guys?
I wasn't as into this season. It was kind of a leading question. Mm-hmm. It was too obviously for the End of Men crowd, to be honest with you. They were targeting us.
I thought the Slate spoiler special they did on Orange is the New Black got to my minor issue with the second season, which is that it's starting to go out of its way to humanize the characters.
Yes.
Like every single character on the show, save for V, the villain, has this completely empathetic storyline. They really shouldn't be there. They're really good people at heart who are in bad circumstances, which I'm sure is true in a lot of cases. But I wouldn't have mind a little bit more, I don't know, villainy. Sociopathy, is that how you say
Alice
that?
Was kind of the villain, but they dispatched with her, you know, really, really quickly. So she was genuinely did something villainous, and then that was it. She was the last.
Yeah, Alex was imprisoned in the Bronx. Is that where she was? Not imprisoned, but like kind of figuratively imprisoned, and then they got her back in stir. So she's taken care of now.
Yeah. Okay, and also I started watching Srugim, the show that June is obsessed with, and so that has occupied my evening TV viewing time fairly obsessively, I would say. So
everyone is watching that. I got to get on that train.
Yeah, it's really good. So the subjects we're going to discuss today are first, dating while mentally ill. Do you make it part of your online profile? Do you stay silent about it as long as you can? We talked to the author of a wonderful Slate story about the subject. Second, the new culture of no body talk at sleepaway camps. Is it exactly what kids today need, or is it just culty? And third, Kim Kardashian Hollywood. We discuss what's looking to be the blockbuster app of this year and how badly each of us wants to be just like Kim, especially Noreen. So let's start with dating while mentally ill. This week in Slate, Molly Polig wrote a very popular story about how to approach your online dating profile and dating more generally if you have a history of mental illness. She writes, "I have no qualms about someone seeing my cellulite, but I'm afraid of him seeing my self-inflicted scars. I'm not sure I would trust a person who had caused herself such violence, so why should he trust me?" Not talking about it, she writes, is unfair and dangerous, but telling too quickly might mean she never gets a date again. We have Molly on the show here to discuss her experiences. Welcome, Molly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, good
okay.
job.
Good, excellent. First of all, I want to thank you for writing this piece. I think it probably wasn't that easy to write because now you really don't have a choice about outing yourself.
Yeah, I'm just a Google away.
You're right. You're just a Google away, so anyone you should happen to date. One interesting point you made was that while it might seem romantic on paper and in songs, it might not seem such that way in real life. What did you mean by that? Sort of what experiences led you to think about that?
Well, I think certainly, at least in high school and college, you know, you present yourself as this sort of wounded bird and people sort of jump in to take care of you. And at the beginning, that's sort of damsel in distress in kind of a terrible way. And then they realize that you might need some help. They might need to help you out a lot more than just stopping you crying. And, you know, it's not like you cry for a while and that's it. It's an ongoing everyday struggle to sort of maintain normalcy.
Yeah, I mean, there is a way in which the culture romanticizes it. Like, I'm thinking of Silver Linings Playbook, you know, a way in which there's this sort of little bit of crazy in all of us. And if we just come together and, you know, that the alchemy is exactly right, then it's sort of the most beautiful thing in the world. And I guess you're saying that's not quite how it plays out.
No, I mean, even going back as like Girl Interrupted, you have this mental institution full of beautiful young things who you're pretty sure that if they just worked a little harder, everything would be okay. It's not something you're going to get over. It's always going to be there.
When would you say you realize this? Because it doesn't come right away, right? Like at first you might just think you're a sort of romantic version of Wounded Bird.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've suffered from depression since I was a child. And for a long time, you tell yourself it's just a phase. It's going to get better. And other people tell you that, too, because other people don't want to admit. I mean, I know it was hard for my parents to say at some point, this is something you're just going to have to deal with. I really think it's only been in the past few years that I've really accepted this is how it is. And I can either try and push it away as hard as I can, or I can accept that it's a part of me and learn how to live with it.
You mentioned a tangle of different issues. You know, you said depression, anxiety, OCD, borderline personality. It seemed to me that these were, you know, these were of varying degrees. Like if you're thinking about it, there's a lot of men who have written about dating women who have had mental illness. And and there's an interesting piece in Alternate about someone who's dating a bipolar person. And the thing that he talked about, which was interesting, which is, you know, do you regard the illness as yourself, as a sort of intimate part of you, or as something slightly external to you? And that seems to make a big difference in terms of how, you know, an intimate partner would deal with it.
I do think of it as a part of myself. And it's hard. It can be hard to remember that it's not all of you. There is so much of me that's not mentally ill. And yeah, these things, they're all varying degrees and they all, some rear their head more than others. I don't even think it's necessarily a bad part of me. It's made me the person that I am, and I'm kind of proud to be the person that I am. This is just my life experience, and these things, as awful as they can be, are what make me me.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering if there was any, one couldn't say upside, but when you wrote about the relationship in which you crashed into each other, it made me think about, you know, what I've read about borderline personality, it shares a lot in common with kind of crazy falling in love, just in general, the kind of urge to fuse, the intensity, you know, the way you can be just kind of, you know, completely different people and have, you know, really, really intense reactions to things that the other person does. Like they do share something in common.
Mm-hmm. The whole borderline personality thing is something that's sort of recent for me. So I'm not sure how much of it is me. I mean, it's always fluctuating. I've always had very, very intense emotions. I just, if I feel something, I feel it a lot, which can be great and it can suck. So I do everything with a sort of degree of intensity. And yeah, it makes falling in love really great because you're wonderful and they're wonderful and everything's amazing and perfect. And that's part of managing it, that you have to, when you have emotions like that, you have to tell yourself, scale it back a little bit. This might not actually be what's happening.
Right, which you also have to do in general when you're first falling in love. So it's probably really hard to pick apart because you did write about yourself as two different people. Like there's this logical side of you that likes to read and is, you know, and then there's this other side of you and it's hard to know, you know, which is which at any given moment.
Yeah.
Molly, how have you dealt with telling people that you've dated?
In the past, I think I've not had much of a game plan, which probably isn't a great idea. I meet someone, we think we're having a good time, and then I'm like, oh, guess what? I'm crazy. I'm kind of crazy. Is that okay with you? And when you present it like that, you know, with someone that likes you already, they're like, oh, yeah, that's fine. I'm sure it's fine. And then at some point, you have to get down to technical details because you don't want the first thing they really see to be you having a panic attack, which can be really ugly. I think in the future, I'm just going to take a much more measured approach, sort of. It's not something I want to hide. It's not something I can hide. But you don't really want to wait till someone really likes you and then they have this dilemma about what to do. But you also don't want someone who doesn't know you yet, doesn't know the good sides of you, to say, oh, that's too much for me. I'm not even going to try. So.
Mm-hmm. So do you just feel your way through when the right moment is to have this conversation? Because it's not
basically.
Like you. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a sense in which the piece was a kind of preemptive disclosure?
Sort of. It was. I mean, it was difficult to write. And I'm putting things down on paper and I think, oh, my God, is that me? Do I do that? And I'm like, yeah, I do. I do that. But it felt really good. And all of my friends and family that have read the piece who know these things about me anyways think it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. So that felt really good.
One of my favorite lines in the piece, I'll just quote it. It's a beautifully written piece. With new friends, I try to rummage around conversationally in their own lives first and drop in a few details to see how they land. I am much better at picking friends than romantic partners. Why do you think that is?
Because when I'm picking friends, I think I'm not focusing so much on myself. Mm-hmm. But when mm-hmm. I'm picking a romantic partner, I think, what do I want? Mm-hmm. When I'm picking friends, I'm really looking for someone that I like, that I can take care of, that I can pay attention to.
How have the reactions been, not just from your family? The comments I thought were incredibly moving and interesting. A lot of people sharing their personal experiences, you know, people who had dated or been married to someone who was mentally ill, who hadn't really talked about it or accepted it for a long time and what that experience was like, and also the opposite. I mean, there was a really intense discussion in the comments section.
I read probably about half of the comments, and I'm just a little bit too overwhelmed. I think what stuck out to me was that a lot of people, when you have one person in your life with a mental illness, you tend to paint everyone with that paintbrush. People were saying, well, I knew this bipolar person, and she shouldn't have done any of these things, and that's what I think, you shouldn't do any of these things, which was hard for me to read. I have received a lot of comments through Twitter and Facebook from people saying, like, I feel like this. I think it's the attitude of people who have that very black and white opinion that keeps other people from saying it. Because I think every day I realize there's more stigma left than I thought there was.
Right. I agree with you about that, that we think that we've gotten to a point where we think of mental illness just like diabetes or any other, you know, revelation that one might make about a long-term problem. But in fact, we haven't. And I think it's especially tricky in romantic relationships because you're looking for a fusing. So, you know, you're asking a lot of someone. And so it is a slightly different calculation than a physical disease. Well, Molly, thank you so much for coming on and talking more about your story. It really is beautifully written. And I think, you know, it really reveals a lot just universally about dating, even without a mental illness, and when you should disclose things about yourself and just how to delicately manage that process. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So now let's move on to our second topic, which is the Happy Summer Camp. A New York Times story earlier this summer profiled a few summer camps that have no body talk rules, meaning no talk about you or other people's bodies. Instead of complimenting how people look on a Sunday or a Saturday, for example, you would say your soul shines or I feel happy to be around you. I do feel happy to be around you guys. I feel okay saying that. Or you say don't check your appearance, check your soul. This seems like a pretty good idea. We all know girls can just size each other up by their fashion choices, their diet successes. After all, Kim Kardashian is in this world, and we are all governed by her. But does it repress too much, and does it create a culty atmosphere? So have either of you guys ever been to a place that is governed by these rules where you're not allowed to say that someone is beautiful or looks good or is fat or whatever?
No.
No, I never really did summer camp at all.
I didn't either in the sort of traditional way. So we're not going to be very much use in this segment. But I found this alarming. This is like PC culture gone wrong. I'm going to sound like an old Republican now. But that just seems like if an experience like camp is supposed to be preparing you for the world, I'm not saying that you should be judged harshly on your appearance all the time, but you should acknowledge that you have a physical presence in the world. And part of camp, I think, is about like learning about your physicality in a way that you don't get to in school. It's about using your body in all these fun different ways. And if you're just going to ignore one aspect of that, that seems very odd.
But maybe summer camp is designed to be a respite from the world, that you have this little controlled experiment site where you can infuse people with, you know, intense positivity that they can then take out into the world and preserve in the wicked school environment that they generally spend most of their time in.
You just sounded like a cult leader right now.
I was trying to sound like a cult leader. I don't actually mind the no body talk. I think that's okay. I mind the enforced positivity. In other words, that everything has to be happy and positive. I actually think that is scary as an atmosphere to be around. And a very good friend of mine just sent her daughter to a camp like this. I think that summer camps are becoming like this generally. The no body talk may be particular, but there is an element of summer camp which is kind of enforced kindness, you know, that we should all be kind to each other. And this sounds like a good idea, right? Like it's okay to be kind to each other. But the way my friend described it, it was rather extreme. She went to a parents' weekend. Do you guys mind if I read this email she just sent to me?
No.
She says, what I think is most interesting, it's not just the hegemony of kindness. It's that you are being watched to make sure that you are kind. So her daughter, when she asked her what was bothering you about camp, she said, I didn't like that I was always being watched. So she felt like she had no privacy and that it was more about that than anything else. She felt that her thoughts were being monitored. I actually talked to her daughter because I saw her on the day she came back. And she said that you couldn't say, what was the phrase? It was something like you're harshing my buzz, but it was even more gentle than that.
Harshing my mellow?
No, no. They're very young. And so I'm going to remember it in a minute. But there were sort of even a very gentle phrase that says like, oh, really, man, like something like that was really not allowed. So she said she had to be careful all of the time. And so that there were visuals like you have to put on sunblock, bug spray, happy chimney feet, water bottle, and a smile. And then
what are happy chimney feet?
That was
what
just
the hell?
That's just one of the phrases. It was like this happiness. And she says, for example, they had to do a buddy check every 3 to 5 minutes. Like every 3 to 5 minutes, you had to, you know, get out of the water and count off and make sure that your friend was there. It was like this enforced sense of community.
Were there like Jim Jones white knights in this place? Like this is crazy.
3 minutes. How do you get anything done?
All right. I was trying to like create I was trying to create nuance, and I've done the exact opposite here. All right. Let me read you a letter. You tell me if you think this letter is beautiful or not. So this is a letter written by the daughter's friend. They're both 10 years old, and it's a cute letter from one kid to another, and you can think of this letter as a result of this indoctrination. So you tell me if you think this letter is, you know, something you would like your child slash future child to write to their friend. Thanks for being such a great friend. Your big hugs and warm smiles really cheered me up when I was down. Thank you for being an encouraging, supportive friend! Hope to see you again soon. Your bunkmate.
okay, that's an adorable letter, but is she writing that so the censors, like, don't get angry at her? Like, is there a secret code embedded that's like, send help if you read every fourth letter?
The Politburo reading it before it goes out?
I mean, it's cute, but how is this the way to teach? I don't know. I think it would just make people very cynical about what kindness
totally.
Is.
Totally.
I mean, I think, you know, it would make my 13-year-old daughter, like, so beyond cynical. I can't even imagine. Like, she would, you know, dig deep and find even more cynicism than she has in such an atmosphere. But if you think of a 9 to 10-year-old, I think the problem is a little different. It's the absence of friction and hierarchy is sort of exhausting. Like, it's hard to find yourself in that kind of atmosphere. It's hard to, you would feel sort of lost in space, right? Friction is actually a way of cementing relationships and finding your place and having intense experience. I don't know, did either of you read the novel The Interestings by Meg Wolitzer?
Yes.
No.
Okay, so we did an audio book club about it. And this is a novel about the experience of summer camp and how it carries over into this group of friends and their lives. And it's very much about hierarchy. Like, there's a group of cool kids that this one slightly outsider then girl and ultimately woman wants to be included in. And the distinctions both in their success and the money become an essential part of why the camp kind of lives on in her mind. And I say this as someone who had a terrible, like, my only traumatic experience of my childhood that I recall strongly happened in camp, right? On the other hand, I recall it pretty strongly. And I remember, you know, I kind of learned a lot from it. I mean, it's just this idea that friction is bad. You know, it's like I wrote in my Atlantic overprotected kid piece, like, we have a sense that protecting kids from friction is the way that we need to teach them things.
And so where did it come from? Did this impulse come from the same place as the overprotected parenting movement?
I mean, I think it comes from the fact that summer camp in the parenting atmosphere that we are in now seems anachronistic, because the idea of putting your children somewhere where you can't really have a lot of communication with them requires a big counterreaction. So the camp has to, I'm not sure about this because my kids won't go to summer camps. They barely leave the house. So I can't get them ever to go to summer camp. I mean, sleepaway camp, much as I would like to. But I think this is like a really intense way of letting parents know that no harm is going to come to their children. So they have to do it in this very public way. So, for example, my one kid who goes to sleepaway camp goes to a computer programming camp at a local college, right? And the kids who run the camp are a little spectrum-y because, you know, it's like Silicon Valley. Like, that's just the atmosphere of programmers. And so he didn't finesse this delicately, but he said to me as I dropped off my son, is there anything else I can do to make you not worry, Mom? And I was like, I'm not worried. It's cool. He's in his dorm room. But you know what I mean? They've received the message that, you know, kids are watched. It's like I said in my Atlantic piece. So, like, kids are watched. So they sort of carry that. They want to make you absolutely sure that nothing bad is going to happen to them in summer camp. Does that sound like cynical parenting philosophy
to
you?
No, it just bums me out. It seems like summer is the time when you should not be watched a little bit. Even
right.
If the rest of the year you're very programmed.
Right. And summer's almost the time when slightly dangerous things should happen. I mean, sleepaway camp, you know, the whole lore of sleepaway camp when I was, what's that song? Hello, Mother. Hello, Father. Mm-hmm. You know, here I am at Camp Granada. I had a sense when I was growing up that sleepaway camp was kind of hell. You know, that like really wicked things, you would get wedgies all the time and people would be like sharpening sticks. You know, there was a sense that like sending you away to sleepaway camp was like sending you to some crazy, intense experience, like sharpness and edges. And I think that the parenting culture wouldn't tolerate that anymore. We don't want, you know, some sleepaway camps have to really eradicate their reputation of the hello mutter, hello fodder. Like, you know, they have to, you know, like all that. Last year, I remember writing a blog post last year or the year before, because the New York Times does a story about some, you know, summer camp every year. It was about food at summer camp, and it had all these lavish pictures of like the incredibly healthy food, and that had a culty edge too. I remember writing about this, like, you know, all candy bars will be confiscated, you know, like if you hide cookies in that shoebox under your room, like you will be strung up in the camp.
Do you guys think that efforts to police language just in general are kind of doomed? Like, going back specifically to the no body talk camps. I mean, do you ever really extinguish what it is that's on a girl's mind, or do you just kind of tamp it down and ascribe shame to it? Because I feel like, you know, we've already ascribed shame to our bodies anyway, or a lot of us do. So I just feel like Can't you just change the subject? I mean, why have a blanket ban on certain kinds of talk? I mean, if you are going to be overseeing the children fairly closely, just change the subject.
I mean, I really liked what Katie Waldman, and when she wrote about the New York City Girls Project a few months back, which, in, you know, the slogan was, "I'm beautiful the way I am," or "just the way I am," something like that. And I thought Katie made an interesting point, which is that beautiful has a specificity to it. You know, substituting beautiful for like awesome, cool, proud, empowered is probably a bad idea, because that does give girls the notion that, you know, everything goes under the grand umbrella of appearance. But I think, you know, if someone tries really hard on a Sunday and puts on their nicest clothes, you can say you look beautiful, but you're referring to them looking beautiful, you know, whereas in mm-hmm. other, you can say you're also awesome. You know, your soul shines. Like, what kid? That's just weird, right? Like, what kid in 2014 wants those words to come out of their mouth, you know?
Yeah, the Tyra Banks flossom campaign where you celebrate your flaws are flossom, does the same thing. It fixates on appearance. It just fixates on appearance in the guise of not fixating on appearance or celebrating what is not typically beautiful. But it's all, I just feel like it's all part of the same continuum. And the camps are fixating via denial.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You know what I mean? They're making an obsession out of it by denying that it exists.
Right. You are a corporeal being. You cannot get away from that. I was thinking a lot about, because I didn't go to camp, but I was sort of a pool rat and I was a swimmer and then I would just stay at the pool all day. So I just thought about people's bodies all the time during the summer. And actually, I think that just made me so much more comfortable with my own, like, way into adulthood, because I just, like, you know, okay, swimsuits, bodies, there they are. Like, and we all just, like, talked very frankly about them.
And there's something particularly healthy about being on a swim team, because the best swimmers are never super skinny girls
right.
in a string bikini. They tend to be stronger. They tend to be bigger. So, yeah, I think spending a lot of my teen years in a bathing suit in this weird way actually helped me with all these body image issues.
Right, because you just sort of see that everyone has a body that's slightly different and they're out there. And you can, like, sort of talk and be like, oh, yeah, my shoulders are bigger than yours. Like, can we wear the same shirt, though? Yeah, we totally can't. Like, it's just, I don't know, you want to talk about that when you're that age.
I also think maybe not at 9 or 10, although it's starting, but a little later as you're edging towards puberty, your body is a freak show. I mean, you are just
is that the talk you're going to give your daughter?
Yes.
Your body.
I don't have to give her the talk. Like, I mean, it is
my swim coach gave me that speech when I was 14. I'll never forget it.
It's like, no, but it's like, it is, this is where sort of myths and lures and, you know, sort of werewolves and Frankensteins, like, bodies are going through things which are so odd and alien. It's a little bit like the experience of being pregnant, honey, over there. It's like, you know, crazy things are happening in your body that seem just crazy, like the way you smell and the hair and the period, you know, all of it is just kind of nuts. You know, you're going from girlhood. It's very hard to ignore your body is what I'm saying. Like, you can go through phases of life where you're just kind of a walking brain, right? Like, there's nothing interesting happening in your body. You're just walking around. But, you know, but ages 10 to 13 is not one of those times where you can very easily ignore your body, you know? So I think it probably takes a lot of effort on the part of these kids. I mean, I'm always conflicted about this anti-bullying, anti-body stuff, because I have my middle son is someone who clearly would have been bullied in a different era, and he has benefited from the fact that bullying is unacceptable and that things, you know, you can't say certain things to kids. Now, I fully well know that kids are thinking certain things, and it hasn't, you know, saved him from his place in boyhood or anything like that. But I am nonetheless grateful that, you know, I think probably this helps people, I guess. I don't know. I think it probably goes both ways.
Yeah, but you can't be, this just strikes me as weirdly Victorian to
right.
sort of sweep it all under the rug. It's like a combination of Victorian and like 60s hippie, and it's an odd combination.
Right. Okay, so we agree. We're anti-body talk. We're anti-no-body talk. We want to create, and this is going to lead us into our next subject beautifully, an all-body talk camp.
We are anti-body talk.
Exactly. Where all you can talk about is everybody's body and how hot they look. And that leads us to the Kardashian game. About a month ago, a San Francisco-based app maker launched Kim Kardashian Hollywood, and the game became a monster hit. It's currently at number 5 or number 1, depending how you count, has tens of thousands of 5-star reviews. In the game, you get to be Kim Kardashian's friend, you get to earn money to try on and buy awesome outfits, you go to photo shoots and parties, and if you're lucky, you climb your way up from E-list to A-list. Which I definitely did not do. I can't even believe there is an E-list. But mostly you get to contemplate the nature of celebrity and whether your dream of being as famous and awesome as Kim is really all it's cracked up to be. Okay, so how much time did you guys log on the game? How much time could you make yourself play the Kim Kardashian game?
15 minutes.
Really?
I did 3 non-consecutive hours.
Wow. So why 15 minutes, Noreen? You're just not a gamer. Like, you're just not into games.
I'm not into games. I didn't get the point of this one. I found it frustrating. And I then read a bunch of articles about the Kim Kardashian game, which probably says more about the way my mind works. I would rather read about something than do it, maybe. And so the appeal, as I understand it from these articles I read on the internet, is that it's sort of deeply ironic about what being a Kardashian means and about sort of the Kardashian value system, where you trade free clothes for whatever status.
Oh my God, Noreen, you sound like you're 90 years old. I was like, on the subway, someone gave me the free newspaper and it has a quote from John Dingell, who's 88 years old, because the EPA, you know, tweeted by mistake something about the Kardashian game. And John Dingell says, "Staff has now informed me of what a Kardashian is." That's what you sound like a little bit.
No, I know very well what a Kardashian is.
The EPA, by the way, had made it to the C list when I sent that tweet out.
That's so better than me.
Yeah. I only made it to the D-list.
You were into it. You were like tweeting up a storm about it.
I was into it until I got the hang of the game. Like, for about 2 hours, I was completely hypnotized by this game. And I think, to the game's credit, it approximates the kind of glassy-eyed, hollow, complacent monotony of trying to aspire to be a D-list starlet.
Can you describe the game a little bit? Because I'm sure people haven't, you know,
of course,
played it.
So you start out, you work at a retail store, and you're closing up for the night, and Kim Kardashian comes by, and she needs an outfit, and she says, "Can you open the store for me?" And of course, you say yes. There is an option to
say no. I said no, and then they were like, "Really? Are you sure?" And then they stopped letting you say no.
Yeah, there's no game if you say no, Noreen.
I know, I learned that quickly.
Then you go into an alternate reality where you become a marine biologist or something.
E-list, that's E-list.
An E-list marine biologist. So you let Kim in, and Kim picks out an outfit, and Kim really likes you and thinks you're cool and likes your look and wants to start introducing you to her publicist or her agent. And so the idea is that you're as charming and agreeable as possible, and you sort of do what Kim tells you to do, or what Kim's people in Kim's orbit that you're introduced to are telling you to do. So you might have to walk down the runway at some, you know, terrible E-list fashion show or something, or you have to go meet with an agent, or you have to do an appearance, quote unquote, at some highly lit, underpopulated restaurant. And one of the quirks of the game that I kind of liked is that you have very limited movement. So when you do the runway show, you just stand at the back of the runway. You don't actually walk down it. When you make the appearance at the restaurant, there are like 3 people to talk to. And you immediately...
Wait, you don't talk to them. You flirt or network.
You flirt or network. And you, you're always at risk of running out of energy. So at one point, I went on a date with a guy, and I was supposed to exchange romantic glances with him. That was one of my tasks. Another task was to flirt. Another task was to order the chef's special. And I had run out of energy, so I had to acquire more energy to exchange romantic glances.
So you take cocaine in the bathroom.
So the energy units are these little lightning bolts, but it's blatantly Adderall or cocaine or something. The lightning bolts are just a metaphor for, you know, the mass quantities of Ritalin that that you're taking to stay up all the time, exchanging romantic glances and ordering chef specials. And so you can either put your phone aside for an hour and let it rest, and when you come back, you'll have more energy, or you can just buy more energy. And so a lot of the people that I was seeing on Twitter who had become instantly addicted to this game were shelling out $5, $10, $20, $50 to get more and more energy so that they could keep playing it. So the people who made it to the C-list really quickly were shelling out a lot of money. I did not want to spend any money, and I doubted that Slate would want to reimburse me for such research expenses. So I had to keep putting my phone aside. But that's the game. You're trying to become one of these people who is famous for being famous. You know, someone who shows up at vodka launches and runs in, walks in runway shows and so forth, and just sort of becomes famous by hanging around and going to all the right places.
But people like the game because it has a sense of humor for itself. Like, it makes fun of that idea of living in a totally claustrophobic universe where you don't actually, you know, speak to any humans or have really any human interchanges. You just, like, network or flirt or, you know, exchange romantic glances, where you move up in life by marrying another person who's famous or, you know, hooking up with another person who's famous, where everybody has, like, their status, you know, like in Gary Steingart stuff. Like, you know, their status is just like a bubble over their head, you know, so you can know
exactly
like what someone's status is at any given moment. And then there's, you know, you quickly run into this bitchy celebrity named Willow Pape, who's, you know, Paris Hilton-like celebrity who says, you know, ridiculous bitchy things at you. And the agent, this guy Simon, is a buffoon who's always making, you know, goofy dad jokes and stuff. And so you feel like, you know, I don't know if Kim K had anything to do with it. Like, if she is part of why this is funny, it doesn't seem like it. But it is. But I think, you know, the reason that people can admit that they really like the game, you know, that people are not just playing it ironically and like in a kind of I'm wasting time and I'm, you know, laughing at the game way, is because the game is laughing along with you about that world. Right.
Yeah, and you immediately absorb into your bloodstream the values of the game. Like, I remember early on, I went to Panino to do an appearance.
Don't look at me. You're like, oh, you know that restaurant, Panino.
And this guy approached me, and his status came up over his head, and I think he was E-list, and he was a social worker. And I felt very conflicted about, should I spend any energy talking to this E-list social worker? Probably not. I can't run out of lightning bolts talking to this guy when maybe that guy over there is a fashion photographer. So you instantly clue in to how you are supposed to behave and think in this world.
My favorite detail about the game, which I learned from an article on Vulture, was that a plane ride to Miami only costs $15, but a bus ride to Calabasas costs $20. So it's like more punishing in this world to take a bus a short distance than to take a plane.
I don't think I'm allowed into Calabasas. I think Calabasas is still locked for me.
Oh,
maybe you have to get
bad.
To C-list to get
bad.
To Calabasas. But there is one very confusing moment in the game for me. I was supposed to do a magazine layout, a fashion spread for a magazine. And that's also really confusing because I could only afford one outfit. So the whole time I was doing this fashion shoot, I was just standing there in like the clothes I had worn to the shoot because I couldn't afford to buy clothes for it makes no sense. It just doesn't make any sense. At one point, I purchased an apartment, but I couldn't afford to furnish it. So right now I'm living in an empty apartment like in downtown LA. But Kim, when I was doing this magazine shoot, asked me to fly to Miami to work in a Kardashian boutique.
Wait a minute. You guys are on a first name basis now? Jessica and Kim?
Sorry, Ms. Kardashian requested that I fly to Miami to work in one of her boutiques. And I did it because Kim was asking me to do it. And you just do whatever Kim tells you to do. But I didn't think that that was very good for my career to leave the magazine shoot, you know, halfway through and just fly to Miami to fold clothes for the day. But I think I did get some dollars and lightning bolts out of it. So that was good. One other thing I really like about the game is that every time you earn more stars and more dollars, which is the currency of the game, they kind of fall onto the floor. So you always have this image in your head of like crawling around to like collect your dollars at the end of the night, which I thought was appropriately abject.
Well, okay. So there was a big Kanye West interview in GQ this month, and he talks a lot about, I mean, you should just stop listening to us and go pick up this magazine
interview.
But at the end, he's talking about Kim and their relationship and celebrity. And he says, to win at life, you need some Kim K skills. And he's not talking about the game, but that's sort of what he means, right? Is that you need to be like, according to the Kanye West way of seeing the world, you need to like be able to approach the world in this extremely pragmatic, I would say somewhat grasping way, but like in the modern 2014 way of American capitalism, maybe you do need some Kim K skills, whatever those are.
I was specifically going to ask Noreen, who is our resident Kardashian scholar, what Kim K skills are, because it's actually, after 3 hours of playing this game, it's not entirely clear to me what those are.
Well, I think it's, I mean, I'm going to come across as like very critical of Kim Kardashian, which is maybe not entirely untrue, but I think it is just like, grasping is a loaded term, but I think that it is not an inappropriate one to apply to the Kardashians. I think it's just like, do whatever it takes to get in the right place to, you know, have people pay attention to you, and then the money will come rolling in.
Noreen, you're such a nice person that you feel
the money will
self-conscious.
Fall onto the floor.
You feel self-conscious about criticizing the Kardashians?
I mean, the Kardashians,
The slate pitch on the Kardashians would be that they're awesome,
right,
and they're philanthropists.
Well,
and they're,
you know, one of the reasons...
They're democratic. They have a democratic approach to celebrity.
And they love family.
In this game. They love family. Yeah,
the family thing is actually what I do like most about the Kardashians. And my lingering sort of affection for the Kardashians comes because my little sister is obsessed with the Kardashians. She loves watching it. She likes their sisterly dynamic. And I actually do like that, too. They sort of fight with each other in a real way, but also like protect each other in a real way, and which is just what sisters do. And people like to say that they are like the American family, like, and that is why people like them, because the American family is broken up. But the Kardashians, you know, they're this blended family where they all love each other so, so much. And I get some of that. But I think actually it's not Kim K skills. It's like Chris, whatever her last name is. What is her last name?
Chris Jenner.
Chris Jenner.
It's like her skills, which is just like total conniving, like sacrifice all of your emotional good to get ahead, seems to be what is being promoted in the Kardashian universe.
I mean, she's the Wicked Witch of that show. I'm sort of in between Jessica and Noreen. I played for like an hour with my 13-year-old daughter's friends, and then kind of got diverted to watching vintage Keeping Up with the Kardashians and New Kardashians and reading all about Bruce Jenner, and then diverted to Kanye. And then I realized what was interesting about this game is how she reimagines her and Kanye's dysfunctional relationship with celebrity. Because in the game itself, Kim is like much cooler and calmer around celebrity than she actually is in real life. Like, she's not the jealous one, right? There are other jealous bitches around, but she's not one of them. And she's like really cool and likes to help the upstarts, right? Like, she's the kind of woman who just, you know, finds another cute woman at a boutique and helps her out, you know, get a photo shoot. Like, that's the kind of person she is. And when actually the Kanye Kim relationship with the celebrities, with the notion of celebrity, is nuts. Like, everything Kanye says is just, you know, crazy, crazy egotistical. Like, in one of these interviews, they talk about how Kanye at his wedding gave a 45-minute toast to himself.
No, not to himself. He clarified
to
that.
To celebrity. He says, what I talked about in it was the idea of celebrity and celebrities being treated like blacks were in the 60s, having no rights, and the fact that people can slander your name. That's what I said in my toast. You know?
I mean, he must be fucking with us, right? Like,
you can never tell if he's fucking with us, but in the game, she's kind of like Jay-Z, you know? Like in Holy Grail. She's like pretty cool. Like, she recognizes that celebrity is kind of a funny thing. You know, she's much chiller than she is. Like, there's the most recent Keeping Up with the Kardashians has the one where she and Kanye make it on the cover of Vogue, and she's like totally forlorn because her sisters don't recognize how important this moment is to her. I mean, they're just like nuts on the show.
Well, her sister, okay. So the post Kanye Kardashian era is an interesting one, because I think you're kind of conflating Kanye and Kim. I think Kim is like a total blank slate, and that's what Kanye loves about her. He's always wanted to sort of Pygmalion his ladies. He had that woman whose name I totally forget before with the
Amber
with the cool hair, the baldish head, who he dressed up. And Kim's personality, she's always been the Kardashian with the least personality. She's sort of probably like the hottest one, which is why she's the most famous one. but the other ones have actual personalities and they sort of drive the show. And then in the post-Kanye era, so Kanye has sort of like made Kim start wearing neutrals and looser fitting clothing. And she there are scenes where she's walking around her mom's house and telling her mom basically how tacky everything is. And so her sisters have sort of like closed ranks against her a little bit. And it's very sad to watch. They're like a little bit offended that she's, you know, calling their lifestyle and their taste, for which they all became very famous together, that she's now decided it's tacky.
All I wanted to do, Noreen, was bring out the scholar in you. And I succeeded in doing that. I was looking for a Kardashian lecture, which you were holding back from us.
This is all, a lot of it is cribbed from my little sister. The last time I really in earnest watched the Kardashians was with my sisters on a rainy day. And it was like in preparation for this season. They were airing every Kardashian episode ever. And we watched a few hours. I'm not going to lie.
Do they like the up and coming Kardashian sisters?
I don't know. We're not as deep into it as it might appear, but I know you have a theory about the young upcoming Kardashians.
Kylie and Kendall
is like a fashion model.
Yeah.
I don't really have a well-developed theory about the younger Kardashians, except that they grew up in an era of complete non-normalcy. Like, they've never known a life where they weren't being watched or on TV. So I think they kind of live in the Hollywood Kardashian game. Like, that actually is their entire life. They've never known another set of references. So they're not acting the way the older Kardashian sisters are. This is actually where they think the horizons are. That's what they've always known. So I don't know if that makes them more pure, more pitiable, or more evil. I can't tell.
Yeah, I can't really get a sense of their personality.
Can we get back to Kanye's influence on Kim for a moment? So, Noreen, is Kim sort of this Warholian art object to Kanye, and he's sort of lost track of the fact that there is like a working mind inside there, and losing track of the friction that he's creating between his art object and the rest of her family? Because he's talked about how nice it is to be part of a big family and to have someone, he says in GQ, about how it's great to have someone to call mom again. Although some people thought he was talking about Kim and some people thought he was talking about Chris. I don't know.
Or Bruce,
mom?
Possibly.
Bruce, right, because Kanye's mom passed away and he didn't have a big family. And so I find that very sweet. I find Kanye to be very pure-hearted. Like, I actually don't think he's fucking with us. I think whatever comes out of his mouth is what he actually thinks and feels. So I'm sad to hear that Kanye might be coming between Kim and her family, although her family is such a nightmare that maybe that's a good thing.
No, I mean, I think he clearly loves the whole family thing, and that is what a lot of people find appealing about the Kardashians. You can't speculate. One should not speculate.
Oh, of course right. You can.
Well, I mean, I honestly don't know what celebrities, what their real relationship is, but I will say, I don't know if this is true. A couple of people have told me this. I've not bothered to Google. But supposedly before Kanye and Kim got together, often when he would have sex with a woman, he would play the Kim Kardashian sex tape with Ray J in the background.
Whoa.
He would just like play it. And so she was like his ideal woman.
Wow.
You know, that does suggest that there is an extra layer of something going on, that it wasn't just like a meeting of minds. that there is like, to him, she is just like woman. Like, she is Helen of Troy. She is just this blank Warholian canvas, as you're saying.
Right.
Noreen, man, you all that pre-apologizing was just so that you could drop that one bit of gossip at the end, you know, which is like the meanest thing.
Unconfirmed ever. Gossip, but I believe it.
Okay, so let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first? The sex tape is your recommendation.
I haven't actually seen it. I've heard it's good? I don't know. My recommendation is actually a Wikipedia page, not because it's one of these super interesting Wikipedia pages, just because it's a good list of movies to watch. I just happened to be talking about Comedies of Remarriage with a friend and navigated over to the Wikipedia page on it. And it's basically, if you want to a primer on good old movies to start watching, just go to this Wikipedia page. I'm just going to read off a few of them. It Happened One Night, The Awful Truth, Bringing Up Baby, The Philadelphia Story, His Girl Friday, The Lady Eve, Woman of the Year, Adam's Rib. I mean, just like every great movie from that era was a comedy of remarriage. So that's a good place to start if you want to watch old good movies.
What's the page actually called?
Comedies of Remarriage, Wikipedia. Comedy of Remarriage.
That's extremely useful. So I am going to recommend Roz Chast's book, which we're going to talk about in the audio book club. Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? She's a New Yorker cartoonist, and this is a book about her aging parents, which is extremely poignant and funny, and which we will talk about more, as I said, on the audio book club. Jessica.
I want to recommend, if you're on Instagram, following Laura Kitty. That's the Instagram handle of Laura McLaws Helms. She's a fashion historian. She has this bottomless trove of fashion magazines from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and she posts a lot. So whenever I look at Instagram, I'm guaranteed to see something beautiful dug out from an old Vogue or a Harper's Bazaar. She's also something of a collector herself. So mixed in with all these gorgeous magazine spreads, you know, you'll have Love Story era Ally McGraw with a huge bouquet of flowers, or you'll have, you know, David Bailey shooting Jean Shrimpton for the cover of Vogue or whatever. Mixed in with all that, she'll post a selfie in one of her many, many flowy 70s vintage floor-length dresses. It's sort of like Fairy Queen mixed with Disco Queen. That's kind of her style. So if you want to prettify your Instagram feed, follow Laura Kitty.
I just followed it while you were talking.
Good job.
So thank you all for joining us today. For more information about what we talked about today, please go to our show page, slate.com/XXGabFest. Also, send us an email if you have comments on today's show or suggestions about what we should talk about next. Our email is XXGabFest@slate.com. Thank you to Mike Volo for engineering and producing this show. Thank you to our intern, Laura Smith, for her research for the show today, which was excellent, by the way. And thank you to Jessica and Noreen for the XX GabFest. I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk in a couple of weeks.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.